Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks very much for tuning in. The country of Afghanistan is now getting a level of attention it has not received perhaps since it was invaded by the Soviet Union in 1979. It seems now increasingly likely that sometime in the near future that the United States will be sending troops into the country in an attempt to capture Osama bin Laden. He is the man that the United States believes is ultimately responsible for the attacks that took place on the 11th of September in New York and in Washington. All of this perhaps makes it more important than ever that we understand and know Afghanistan. And with that end in mind, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the Afghans, their culture, their country, with Thomas Barfield. He's professor of anthropology and chairman of the Department of Anthropology at Boston University. Before taking up that position in 1989, he taught at Harvard. He's done extensive field work in among nomads in northern Afghanistan, as well as a shorter period of time in Xinjiang. In Western China. Most recently, some of the work that he's been doing looked at the problems of economic change and nationalism in post-Soviet Uzbekistan, and he also has been involved in some applied work on refugee repatriation and war reconstruction for Afghan refugees in Pakistan. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have also a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match those numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL, which probably doesn't make it any easier to do. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Barfield, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Sure.
It seems to be this is one of those cases, and unfortunately we seem to face it quite a bit, that we find ourselves involved in a part of the world that we don't know very well, and that people, and it certainly happened on this program, and I'm sure it happens elsewhere, find themselves asking the most basic questions about this place, like, who is it? What's the geography like? What's it look like? What are the people like? What are their daily concerns? What's their life like? And it seems kind of unfortunate that we have to perform that level of education for people when we come to a point like this, but that seems indeed to be where we are.
Sure. Well, Afghanistan is a country about the size of Texas, so it's relatively large. It's surrounded by other nations, that is, it's landlocked. And because of that, it shares borders with a number of different regions. In the north, the ex-Soviet states of Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan form its northern border. Its western border is on Iran's frontier, and its southern border and its eastern border is Pakistan. So it lives in a rather difficult neighborhood. But the other thing that's important on that is that it sits at the center of sort of a crossroads. It used to be one of the ancient Silk Routes crossroads. And what that means is that every one of those countries I've mentioned has sort of co-ethnics that live on the Afghanistan side of the border. And for that reason, all the politics that take place in Afghanistan have ramifications for the other nations in the region. Hmm.
That points to the next question that I was going to pose, and that is, do people in Afghanistan think of themselves as Afghans, or do they think of themselves as something else? Perhaps they identify with their ethnicity or that sort of background, and the idea of nationalism, the way we think about it, is not something that most Afghans would hold.
In general, Afghans maintain a strong local level identity. This can be based on their ethnicity and language. It can be based on religious affiliation. It can be based on region of the country. But in general, local ties are very strong. And as you move up, these ties get weaker and weaker. There is never has been really a strong internal idea of Afghan nationalism. But where that idea does become very strong is when Afghanistan has faced the outside world. So when the Soviet Union invaded, if anything, it helped forge a sense of national identity because sort of all Afghans were under attack. But this type of identity cannot really be used internally to unite the Afghans.
The country has been torn by about 20 years worth of conflict. The Soviets invaded in 1979, and they were there for 10 years. Then after that, there was civil war. The Taliban came to power in 1996, and now they control something like 90% of the country. And yet the country still is certainly they didn't bring peace to the country. What has happened to Afghan, to the extent that there is such a thing as Afghan society, what has happened to it as a result of now this more than 20 years of war?
Well, Afghanistan is put under a tremendous amount of stress. More than a million Afghans were killed in the anti-Soviet war, and as many as three, perhaps more million Afghans fled to neighboring Pakistan and Iran. The other thing that happened is a people that, by and large, tended to stay in their own areas were uprooted either as international refugees or as internally displaced people. So there was a great deal of disruption to Afghan society. On the other hand, because Afghans have always maintained such strong local identities and very strong kinship ties with their own groups, it's been a remarkably resistant society in terms of not suffering many of the ills that one would associate with long periods of anarchy. These are people that essentially know how to handle their own affairs in the absence of the state.
One of the things that it seems to be the case that when the Taliban came along, there were at least a significant number of people who thought that was a good thing because the country had really been torn by civil war, by warlordism, and that they were seen as a stabilizing force until perhaps people got the idea of what kind of society they had in mind. And now we have seen what life is like in the parts of Afghanistan that the Taliban administer. Is it possible, though, to say even at this point what most people feel about the Taliban and whether they think that was a good thing or a bad thing that they came from Pakistan and essentially took over most of the country?
Most people in Afghanistan probably despise the Taliban. When they first came in, their ideology was certainly not particularly well received. But after 10 years of civil war, anybody that could promise to restore order would be welcome to give a chance to do that. But one of the things that the Taliban failed to do, it never transformed itself from a political religious movement into a government. So it never provided government services and never attempted to rebuild the roads to involve the international community in reconstructing the country. Instead, it focused on enforcing its social views of veiling of women, of making men wear beards, of beating people to go to the mosque. And this really offended a lot of Afghans. And also they saw, there was really no improvement in their situation. And this began to alienate a lot of people. They were also alienated by the fact that while the Taliban themselves come from Kandahar in southern Afghanistan, that their military was very strongly backed by Pakistan, and they had these very close relations with the so-called Arab Afghans, that is essentially foreigners living in Afghanistan, and many Afghans felt that those people had too much influence over the Taliban.
But if there was a perceived threat coming from outside of Afghanistan, would people rally behind the Taliban?
It depends on how that threat is implemented. Afghans in the past have very often taken a wait-and-see attitude to foreign intervention, and in particular whether the foreigners stay in Afghanistan or not. Any type of foreign intervention that's brief and pulls out does not provide a focus to unite the Afghans. They're very pragmatic people in terms of looking how their politics work.
The messages from the Bush administration, as far as the Taliban go, seem to be a little bit mixed. On the one hand, saying that they weren't interested in directly trying to overthrow the Taliban, on the other hand saying that they think that Afghanistan would be a better place without the Taliban. And now it does seem to be the case that the U.S. government is talking about providing aid to this group, the Northern Alliance, that controls this 10% of the country, and is in opposition to the Taliban. Would Afghanistan be a better place if it was run by the people who were involved with the Northern Alliance?
Well, if you look very carefully at the U.S. government's position on this, it did not say it would aid solely the Northern Alliance or put them in power. It said it would aid all Afghan opposition groups. And one of the things that the Northern Alliance has actually been careful to say is that it is not looking to be made the sole governor of Afghanistan, but rather to be part of a larger coalition that would involve all ethnic groups and sort of all political players. The Northern Alliance did rule Kabul at one point, and they didn't do a very good job of it. The great difficulty, which both sides sort of realize, the Northern Alliance represents the northern ethnic groups. They can't rule Afghanistan without the cooperation of the southern groups, the Pashtun people. The Pashtun people have found it very difficult to come to some kind of cohesion around a common political party. The Taliban took advantage of that to seize power. And what everybody realizes is essentially you have to involve all of these groups and come to a sort of a fair power-sharing arrangement in order to make it work. So the United States has not said that it wants to put the Northern Alliance into power, merely that it wants to see the Taliban gone and replaced with a broad-based government. And that's because they realize that the Northern Alliance would fail as a partner if you supported it alone.
Hmm. Well, is such a coming together of various elements in to form a new kind of coalition government, is it reasonable to expect such a thing could happen?
Well, that's one of the reasons there's so much interest in the old king Zahir Shah, because Zahir Shah, who was ousted from power by his cousin in 1973, represents the old monarchy of Afghanistan. And what's important about that is he comes from a Pashtun lineage. That is, he represents the people in the south, but he has fairly good relationships with the other ethnic groups in the country. And many people see the ex-king as a bridge, as a way, not that he would be a great leader in and of himself. He's a very old man, although he looks fairly healthy, and he was never a very powerful ruler when he was in charge of Afghanistan. But that this would provide a bridging mechanism, a way to bring everybody together to create a government. And one of the things you have to realize is that after 10 years of civil war, both sides realize that they really can't do it by themselves.
The former king, Mohammad Zahir Shah, is 86. He's living in exile in Italy. Apparently now a lot of people have been going to visit him, most recently a delegation from Congress, with this very idea in mind that perhaps that he could be a figure around which different people could rally. Do you think, though, that that's a reasonable kind of scenario, that he could indeed be that kind of figure?
Yes, he could. I mean, the thing is that no one's expecting him to go back to Afghanistan to rally the tribes or to make things happen. But he would provide, particularly for the Pashtun people in the south, a legitimate way to shift their allegiance from the Taliban to someone else. But one of the things they would be looking in terms of this coalition government is what kind of resources would be coming from the outside world. What kind of future would Afghanistan have? If this new government was able to supply a tremendous amount of food aid to end the famine and begin to reconstruct the roads, take care of the war damage, perhaps bring in peacekeeping troops to put an end to violence, it would have a very good chance of succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that indeed here the United States has the opportunity to play a positive role that would be seen that way in Afghanistan and in the rest of the world without seeming to be too meddlesome, to be going in and saying, there's this government, we don't like this government, we replace him with this other?
One advantage the American government has right now is it really doesn't care what kind of government it is in Afghanistan, as long as it gets rid of terrorists and brings stability to Afghanistan and to the region. whether that takes an Islamic form of government, a parliamentary system, a monarchy. One advantage here is the United States really doesn't care. That gives it a lot of leeway in terms of accepting any kind of compromise that the Afghans themselves can come to. Secondly, most Afghan governments throughout their history have been unable to survive without outside aid. Going all the way back to the formation of modern Afghanistan in 1880, they've depended very heavily on subsidies from foreign nations. And the bottom line that the Afghans drew was, we don't really care where our governments get their money as long as they represent Afghan interests. And therefore, the fact that you don't have foreign troops occupying the country is important, but if outsiders give aid to Afghanistan and things look better, most people are willing to support it, because most Afghans really don't care what their country's foreign policy is. What they're concerned with is what is their internal policy.
The United States has been providing humanitarian assistance now for some time, before September 11th, certainly we were.
But most people don't realize that when we supported the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, we are providing, we and our allies, providing almost $1 billion a year in aid, partially weapons, but partially humanitarian aid. That aid continued until the Soviet Union collapsed, and then from giving $200 or $300 million a year, we started giving 50, then 15 million a year. So while we may be the largest contributor from Afghanistan's point of view, we walked out. We promised the Afghans, we promised the Mujahideen, you defeat the Russians, and even though this has caused great violence to your own country, we're going to step in with a Marshall Plan, we're going to rebuild. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, we had no interest in Afghanistan, and we let the Afghans sort of sit in the smoking ruins and said, we'll never need this country again, we'll never hear from it again. As far as the Afghans are concerned, they would really like to see us make good on the promise that we made to them when we armed the Mujahideen, that is, that we would restore normalcy to the country in terms of rebuilding its economy, getting the refugees back, and helping a stable Afghanistan. And that's something that we didn't do in the 90s. We created the groundwork for the civil war and the anarchy and the rise of the Taliban. We didn't do it directly, but we created the conditions in which we now find Afghanistan.
And how much money would it cost to rebuild this country?
Well, there was only one road, all right? I mean, we're not talking about a country that had a tremendous infrastructure to begin with. Afghanistan's population is maybe 85% rural, and it's mostly engaged in subsistence agriculture and pastoralism. What we're really talking about is, you know, tens, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars to put the infrastructure back into shape. But this is not necessarily something that the government would have to do over a long period of time, because there's been a great deal of discussion about the building of gas and oil pipelines from Turkmenistan, which has great oil deposits on that Caspian Sea, and having a pipeline that runs through Afghanistan to Pakistan or India. That kind of pipeline would bring $1 billion in royalties to Afghanistan every year. That, and you replace the roads, and it's the linchpin, the trading linchpin between Central Asia and South Asia and the Middle East and Central Asia. So it's not a question of sort of endlessly putting in money. It's essentially a question not of nation building, but of war reconstruction. There's nothing left standing in the country after 25 years of war.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Thomas Barfield. He's professor of anthropology and is, in fact, chairman of the Department of Anthropology at Boston University, and has done extensive field work among nomads living in northern Afghanistan. He's also done some work in western China and in post-Soviet Uzbekistan. And we're talking this morning about Afghanistan, and your questions certainly are welcome, as always, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Do we actually have a way, aside from trying to work through the government of Pakistan, to talk with people in Afghanistan?
Sure. We don't. The only reason we use the Pakistani government is to talk to the Taliban, because they're the only country that recognizes the Taliban. We talk to the Northern Alliance directly. We don't go through Pakistan. In fact, the Northern Alliance is quite hostile to Pakistan. But now that the Russians have become more cooperative, they've allowed the stationing of aircraft and military personnel in the Central Asian republics along the border of Afghanistan. So in some senses, even for military purposes, we don't need Pakistan. We can run this out of Central Asia.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start with a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I am wondering if there's anything left of the University of Kabul. And my husband was the head of a group that asked by the Shah to come over through our State Department to help get the University of Kabul started. My husband was professor and dean of engineering research, and he has gotten three others, a professor of chemistry, a professor of economics, and a professor of agronomy. We were there, and of course, I didn't go into university classes with him, but I did go to girls' schools, and I can hardly talk without crying because it was such a wonderful experience for us. The Shah, Zahir Shah, Muhammad Zahir Shah, sent his children's math teacher over here to meet us before we left, and he stayed with us. And this was all in 1959, and my husband was, I thought he was smart enough. He asked a court recorder to go with us, who every day the four professors met at 5 o'clock with our wonderful interpreter, they reported everything that they had done in their different departments at the university or whatever places they had visited. And I've always wondered if the State Department, that report, I have it. It's about, 3 inches thick at least. And I just wonder if our State Department ever read it, because everything you've said this morning was absolutely what we found. And we were privileged to travel up to Mazar-e Sharif, to Balkh. We met with the Kuchis, the nomads, coming back through the Pamir area, which touches China, and had a very nice experience with the nomads. And we went to Helmand Valley and Kandahar. Ross was interested in the building of the dam down there that the Morrison Knudsen Company from Idaho built in Afghanistan. It was finished before we got there in 1959. I'm the only one left. The four professors have died, but I still have wonderful memories of how gentle the people were. I could get around a little horse-drawn cart. I would come out of our mud brick house and stand in the street, and a little cart with a driver and would come by, and I'd just hold my hand up, and because I had made some friends, or if I wanted to go to a girls' school, I'd learned four words how to get around in Afghanistan, in Kabul. I could say a rubaroo, dusty chop, dusty rust, and bosh. But I just feel privileged to be talking to you this morning, and I would like to have your address. I'd like to contact you and even talk more or hear more from you. You are so right. The people on the northern border and were very, they warned us not to cross the Oxus River because that's when it was the Soviet Union. And, I just won't take any more of your time or other people's time, but I will call Dan Simeone later and ask him for your address in you're in Boston.
Yeah, I'm sure that we can provide you with an address. I don't know, Professor Barfield, what you might want to say. It seems to be pretty obvious, and I know not only from hearing what this caller had to say, but with talking with other people, that there are a lot of Americans that feel ties, feel bonds with Afghanistan that go back a long time.
Well, certainly,
I feel a very close bond in the fact that I'm the only one left. The four professors are all deceased.
Yeah. Professor Barfield?
Yeah, Afghanistan essentially remained closed to foreigners until late 1950s, 60s. It began opening up. That's when both the Russians and the Americans put in the roads, the airports, what infrastructure there was in the country. And then in the 70s, it became one of the major overland routes for young people who were traveling on their way to India. And a lot of people were enchanted by the country and the Afghan people. It is a place that I think anyone who has been there never forgets. And the Afghans actually, although it's a very remote place, all people who have been there, it's a place they not only never forget, but that the Afghans left them with a very warm feeling in their hearts. So despite all the trouble that's been in the country, at least for those people who have been there, it's a place that people would like to see restored and back to the time that they were there.
Let's continue. I appreciate the comments of the caller. Next person in line is in Oakwood. It's line two. Hello.
Hello. I gather the Northern Front has a fair number of troops. Now, how does that compare with the number that the present government has, and are these other groups that you talked about that they would need to work together with, do they have any troops, or is the Taliban willing? I mean, if a coalition could come together, would the Taliban leave willingly, or would they have to be driven out, or what? I'm just wondering how much. I mean, it sounds like it'd be nice to get a more agreeable government that the people would like, but is that really easy to do?
Well, it depends. The Northern Alliance probably has about 15,000 troops, and more or less they can put in sort of a regular order of battle. Many other places in the country, because of the long war in the Soviet Union, you have people that are armed that could choose to join the fight if they do, but currently are under, for example, Taliban rule. So it's hard to know, you know, how many of those people are available. But one of the interesting things that the Taliban itself is a very fractured movement. The people that run its airplanes, that move its tanks, the Afghan soldiers that do that, are actually the leftover communists. What happened was when the Mujahideen took over Kabul, the communist regime didn't simply collapse. Its component parts joined different Mujahideen parties. Largely, they joined their co-ethnics. And since the people that dominated the army under the communists were, in fact, Pashtuns, many people found it amazing, but it was true, they joined with the most radical Islamists because they were also Pashtuns. And when the Taliban took power, even though ideologically you couldn't find two people more apart, as professional soldiers, they stayed on with the Taliban. So there, you have even groups, Afghan groups, that are military units of the Taliban who are not necessarily loyal to the regime. The Taliban itself, it's estimated, has about 40,000 troops. But many of these consist of sort of raw conscripts that they convinced to come in from Pakistani religious schools whose military value is doubtful. You have professional soldiers that have served many regimes. And you have Osama bin Laden's group that also provides its own brigade that fights alongside the Taliban against its enemies. The Taliban itself has some difficulties in determining what its policy should be. There are certainly some Taliban that would probably be willing to join a coalition government if it looked like they were going to be pushed out. But Mullah Omar and his immediate circle will probably fight to the last man. They would have to be pushed out. But in Afghan politics, Some Taliban may decide they don't want to go down with him. It's always possible there could be a coup. Rumor has it that Pakistan is working very hard to see Mullah Omar and his company replaced so that they could save the remnants of the Taliban, because the Taliban have been Pakistan's proxy in Afghanistan, and they're very that's the reason they pushed the United States not to say that the Taliban is a target. They would like to save the Taliban or some remnant of it if they could. But what happens is that every time politics changes in Afghanistan, very often it's the same people, sometimes wearing a different hat. So when we're talking about the Taliban, we're not necessarily talking about a particularly united movement. And in Afghanistan, everybody wants to be on the winning side, just as the Taliban took 9/10 of the country with actually very little fighting. If it looks like the Taliban are going to lose, many of the warlords who joined with the Taliban because it looked like they were winning, particularly in the northern and western part of the country, could immediately switch their alliance, and suddenly we would find that 3/4 of the country is anti-Taliban. That's the way Afghan politics very often works.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, I think that still raises the question of what would happen if a significant portion of the Taliban with military force would decide to leave Afghanistan. They could be certainly be a disruptive force in any place they would go. My guess would be that Pakistan wouldn't want them.
Well, many of them come from Pakistan. Okay, they're Pakistani citizens, some of them. It would depend. If they, if they are leaving without any heavy weapons, they're no more of a force than any other that's along the Pakistani border, where the peaceful people are pretty much armed. But we're talking, a minimal. I mean, the whole Taliban army, according to Jane's Defense Weekly, has only 500 Russian tanks, half dozen operable aircraft, a few helicopters. We're not talking about, a major military force in terms of its equipment or organization.
We are past the midpoint here. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Thomas Barfield. He's professor of anthropology, chairman of the Department of Anthropology at Boston University. Before that, taught at Harvard. He's done field work among people of northern Afghanistan. He's also done some work in Xinjiang, in China, in post-Soviet Uzbekistan, and has taken part in work on refugee repatriation and war reconstruction for Afghan refugees in Pakistan. And we're talking about Afghanistan today. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Bloomington, Indiana. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, Professor Barfield. Since this Taliban government is very religious, we would assume that they're charitable and that they would welcome anyone trying to relieve the suffering of their Afghan people. But there is a German Christian organization called Shelter Now, helping the poor Afghans. And these Shelter Now Christians give the Afghans food, blankets, shelter. They virtually do the same kind of work that Mother Teresa did in India. And it would seem that the Taliban, as fervent Muslims, would welcome these benevolent people, cooperate with them, to help help these poor Afghan people. But instead of cooperating, the Taliban actually has arrested these Christians, and they are now on trial, facing a possible death sentence for their charitable work. Could you explain the thinking of the Taliban, these fervent Muslims? What are they thinking?
The Taliban, and this was actually an issue for earlier Afghan governments, but the Taliban are the most hard line on it, consider apostasy, that is, the conversion of a Muslim to another religion, as a heinous sin that's punishable by death. And they do not consider anyone has the right to change a Muslim's religion to another religion. It's okay the other way, but not that way. And therefore, they've always been very suspicious of charitable groups, particularly religious charitable groups, Christian charitable groups, that the the Afghan belief is that they're not really there to help the people, but to secretly convert them to Christianity. It's almost a paranoia. Religious groups that go in are told, you know, you shouldn't do this. The Afghans are very sensitive about it. But the Taliban have this belief that aid workers are in fact sort of a fifth column designed to subvert Islam in Afghanistan. And actually, you know, nothing could really be further from the truth in terms of both Afghans' interest in other religions, and most of these groups are there in precisely to aid people, not to teach their own religious doctrines. In past governments, when this dispute has arisen, people have simply been deported from the country. The Taliban are first to arrest and sort of prosecute, and that's alienated popular opinion in many parts of the world. It's not just Christians. After all, they blew up the Bamiyan Buddhas earlier this year. That defended the Buddhist world. And I don't think the Taliban were even aware that the Japanese were their third largest humanitarian aid donors and that they were Buddhist. The Taliban have taken a very hard line against pretty much all other religions. This is not in keeping with traditional Islamic beliefs, but the Taliban are not a traditional Islamic movement. They're a movement of very ill-educated mullahs whose knowledge of Islamic law and of the Quran is actually fairly weak. And practically all Islamic nations have condemned Taliban policies well before this September 11th tragedy. Even Iran considers them absolutely outrageous.
Well, when you've got a government like this, it's kind of hard to help their people, isn't it?
They're not interested in helping their people.
Yeah.
And they're interested in preserving their own power and pushing their particular view of Islam. They only let foreigners in because they've actually taken they've created no government infrastructure on their own to attempt to feed their own people or to work out. They rely on the international community to do this. And they know that if the population starves, that they would find it very difficult to hold power. So while they have constant disputes with the international community, they've been loath to break ties because the international community is feeding a good percentage of their people.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Just to go back for a second to the fact, and you talked about the fact that the Taliban in Afghanistan were backed by the government of Pakistan because the Pakistanis wanted to have a government in Afghanistan that they could at least have significant influence over. Given that fact, and no doubt Pakistan's continued desire to have some sort of say in what happens in Afghanistan, is that going to complicate matters if what the rest of the world is going to try to foster is a change in Afghanistan that would be for the better for the people of Afghanistan?
Yes, it will create difficulties, but we have to remember that the United States too often has taken Pakistan's advice during the anti-Soviet war. Pakistan was in charge of giving out the military aid, and they did not give it to the Mujahideen parties that fought best against the Russians. They gave it to the most fundamentalist Islamic groups that they wanted to support. They then decided later on to support the Taliban. And the United States needs to understand that Pakistan has its own self-interests in this area, and that those interests are not always the same as those of the United States. And so while Pakistan has a legitimate concern that a hostile Afghanistan not be created on their border, I don't think the United States should pay too much attention to allowing the Pakistanis to try to set the limits of what an Afghan government should be. The fact is they created a Taliban movement that they can't control. Pakistan itself is under threat for its very existence, and it gets no cooperation at all from the Taliban. It's a type of movement that has come back to bite its master, and that should be a lesson to the United States, too.
We have a caller here, someone on a cell phone. We'll get to them next. Line number one. Hello?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have interest in this. This is a very good topic for us. We hosted a foreign exchange student in the early 70s from Afghanistan, and he speaks Pashto and Persian and English, and it's been 3 to 4 years since we've heard from him because of they actually smuggled a letter out from him through the embassy when they cleared out. And I wanted to know if you had any, we haven't been able to send anything or correspond because they said that we'd be bring him into some danger by having any contact with him, you know, because he speaks English and all that. Is there any hope for these kind of people? You know, he has a family of five and a wife, and in his last letter he said the conditions were deplorable, and I can only assume they've gotten worse in the last 3 or 4 years. Can you comment towards that? Is there any way we can get hope or help to these kind of people?
Well, this is one of the reasons that many Afghans are very interested and might be supportive of a new government, because they see no future for themselves under the current situations, and they're desperate for the reestablishment of normalcy, for the reconstruction of their country, and, you know, to allow such things as education, economic development, trade, all of these things to begin to take place once again in Afghanistan. And in a normal Afghanistan, educated Afghans certainly would be able to find jobs and opportunities in the reconstruction of the country.
I guess my question, if I can interrupt, is how many of these people can be left? People have not only left, but they've been slaughtered. You know, when you have only a few educated people left to deal with that, it's going to be extremely difficult to restart a nation.
Yes, but remember that you have millions of Afghans, including many educated Afghans in Pakistan, in Iran, in Western Europe, and in the United States. If Afghanistan were restored to some kind of stability, such that there was no fighting and there was a political future, millions of refugees bringing their skills with them would return from Pakistan and Iran. Many educated Afghans, people like engineers, physicians, teachers that are in Western Europe or the United States, while they've been in these countries for a long time and might not move their families back, many Afghans have said that if the country is stable again, that they would be happy to devote part of their lives and skills to helping reconstruct the country, and they have money to invest as well. So within the country, you're correct that the number of people around to do these kind of jobs are relatively few, but there's now a very large Afghan diaspora that, given an opportunity to rebuild lives in Afghanistan, would be a major help in that process.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's continue. The next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Yes. I'm really impressed with this kind of anthropological knowledge, and I wonder if the guest has been in touch or been contacted by the United States government, or if there are people with his degree of knowledge in the government that he knows about. I mean, is the government getting advice from people like this? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, the relationship between government and academics is always sort of fraught with difficulties. But even before this problem, I used to go down, still do on a regular basis, to lecture foreign service personnel at the Foreign Service Institute, sort of the postgraduate school for training diplomats. So the government has been interested in bringing in the views of people, you know, in terms of laying out what sort of the culture, the politics, the history that particularly places that Americans are not familiar with. There are not too many people that do Afghanistan as a sort of an academic enterprise. One reason being the 25 years of warfare. I was fortunate enough before the war began to spend 2 years living with nomads in northern Afghanistan, meeting a wide variety of Afghans, traveling, you know, with donkeys and camels high into the mountains that people are now talking about, and essentially living in people's villages, talking with them, and learning about their culture. And that kind of opportunity has become obviously much more difficult over the past 20 years. And therefore, there's been sort of difficulties in doing research there. But also, people in the United States, when countries of the world sort of fall off of our horizon, we tend to forget about them. And therefore, until recently, the amount of interest in places like Central Asia and Afghanistan has been relatively small. Now it's been revived again, but it takes quite a long time to develop levels of expertise amongst lots of students and scholars, and this is something that's been lacking for many years on countries like Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's any indication, the desperate calls now that seem to be going out from the government for people who speak the languages of this region, Arabic, but also I'm sure that there are probably very few people working in the State Department, working in the CIA, wherever in Washington, that speak the languages of Afghanistan.
That's true, but that's also probably our policy. The United States was very involved in the anti-Soviet war, and many American officials were over on the Pakistan border, inside Afghanistan, even helping the Mujahideen. Many of them learned Persian or Pashto. Actually, they don't speak Arabic in Afghanistan. But as soon as the Soviet Union collapsed, all of these people were transferred to other desks, other jobs. We don't need that level of expertise anymore. We'll never see Afghanistan again. So there's a tendency for the government sometimes to be a little short-sighted, that even when we develop an area of expertise, there's a tendency after the immediate problem is gone to just let it dissipate.
We're just about the part where we're going to have to finish, and I must apologize because I have a couple of callers I can't take. This is a difficult question, I'm sure, to answer, but at this point, do you have some sort of feeling about what's likely to happen here in the near future?
Well, this is obviously purely a guess, because all I can do is look at things coming over the news wires, but again, you know, sort of being a little bit familiar with how things work in Afghanistan, I think a lot of groups right now are waiting to see what is the United States going to do, and I wouldn't be surprised if the United States' response to this isn't to go after the Taliban's weaponry. That is, if the Taliban has no tanks, no artillery pieces, and no air force, their superiority over their opponents begins to disappear. The second thing that will happen is that many people that are wondering, is the United States serious or not? If that happens, we'll decide the United States is serious and decide to defect not to the Northern Alliance, but to some kind of new coalition. And at that point, we begin to move into a different arena, that is, of a new government can be created and supported, and famine relief comes in, the country starts to be rebuilt a little bit, even immediately, then it'll be Afghans who are looking to get rid of Osama bin Laden and his cohorts. Because one great advantage we have is that none of the people that we are looking for in Afghanistan are Afghans. They're all foreigners. And while they may hide in the Afghan mountains, that's not where they're from. And if the political climate changes and they lose their protection, the Afghans tend to be sort of xenophobic, but they're equal opportunity xenophobes. That is, they dislike foreigners of all types dominating their country. And it would be the Afghans going into their own backyard to seek these people out. But if even after these terrorist networks are gotten rid of, unless the United States this time and the world community helps in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and bring Afghanistan back to normal, we'll be back there in another 10 years. It's really important to create stability in a land where anytime this thing happens again, it's a criminal problem, not a military problem. And the Afghans, after 20 years of warfare, are not interested in spreading any kinds of ideologies or doing any kind of movements. All they want to do is get their country and themselves back into normalcy. And that's something that I think we did very, very well in Europe, such that countries in Europe, in Western Europe, never even thought about fighting a war again. We need to think about that in terms of Afghanistan, not just be out of the goodness of our hearts, because if we change the landscape and the economy and bring them hope for the future, they will have no interest in movements like the Taliban or extremists like Osama bin Laden.
Pardon me for interrupting you there, Professor Barfield, but I'm at the end of my time, and we're going to have to stop. I appreciate very, very much you giving us some of your time today.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Thomas Barfield, he's professor of anthropology, chairman of the Department of Anthropology at Boston University. Our program made possible in part by a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff there encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Today's broadcast also made possible by